It is Thursday. It is April 12th. You're tuned into The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and co-host Susan Bruce. And it's just a spectacularly beautiful day out there. I hope it's nice where you live. Anyway, where are we taking us? Are we doing a history route? Or are we doing a poetry route? Or
No. Today we're rejoining history.
Oh, good. We're rejoining history. Well, we're making it every day. All right, keep going.
Well, this is especially appropriate for us because here at WNHN we are known to play a lot of jazz music.
We do.
So on this day in 1936, Benny Goodman, Teddy Wilson, and Gene Krupa played the first racially integrated jazz concert in a major venue.
Wow.
It was Easter Sunday at the Congress Hotel in Chicago. Goodman and Krupa were white. Teddy Wilson was African American. There were no protests. Goodman had emerged as a major jazz star, and that gave him clout.
Exactly.
And
he could open doors nobody else could.
He had begun a series of Sunday afternoon concerts at the Congress Hotel. He began the series in November of 1935. So in early spring of 1936, he invited Teddy Wilson, who was a pianist, to come to Chicago and play.
So what was the audience like? Was it a mixed audience? Or oh, wow. Very cool.
Well, or maybe not.
It may have been, but if nothing else, it was mixed on the stage.
It was.
Yeah.
And later that year, Goodman formed a quartet with Teddy Wilson, Gene Krupa, and vibraphonist Lionel Hampton, who was also African-American. And they both went on to become members of his band.
Wow.
And had celebrated jazz careers all by themselves. So thank you, Benny Goodman, for he used his power for good.
He did. And he exposed people to the idea that, guess what? Talent is talent.
Well, in jazz.
You know, especially in
a
jazz.
Uniquely American art form. But music is... Music is everybody's.
It is everybody's. In fact, I can't remember his name. I'm going to be embarrassed. So I was listening to the Poet Laureate of the United States, I think from 2015, and he's a Mexican American, and oh my God, it was so fascinating. He told a story about his father. His poetry is remarkable because it's Spanish and English blended together all the time, and he's a great storyteller. And he played the harmonica. That's why you mentioned music. He played the harmonica, but he told an amazing story, Susan, about his father. And his father comes home and tells his wife that he found a car that was literally buried into the side of a mountain. And he said, I am going to use that car. And his wife goes, for what? That will be the foundation for our house. And he digs this car up and cuts it in half and builds a box on top of it. And he said, and that box became our house. It was our bedroom and our kitchen and our living room. And it was an amazing story about a life that was so damn rich, you know, financially challenged, but had more wealth in relationships and wealth in stories and wealth in theater than you could possibly imagine. It was just a very, very interesting night, and I am so glad that I got to experience it. Now, as you've come to expect, between now and Election Day, guns, guns, guns. And I thought this was fascinating. It's about the race for governor in the great state of Nevada. And the gun control issue has become prominent, in part because if Democratic Chris Cunjagliani is elected governor, all right, she wants to bolster gun control background checks, keep firearms out of classrooms, and ban assault rifles and bump stocks. And she's taken a firm stance against allowing guns in classrooms. She notes her policy outline that she would veto any measure that would arm teachers. Now, this is what you need to know about the Democrat who's running for governor in Nevada. The former special education teacher said she's waiting to see what school safety recommendations come out of Sandoval's task force. There's a task force going on right now in Nevada. But Cunjagliani vowed to find funding for safety fixes deemed most crucial, saying the protection of students and staff must be paramount. And then she goes on to say, as community members, educators, and elected officials ponder ways to enhance school safety, Kunjigliani said she hopes they look for solutions that don't ruin the positive atmosphere where students are inspired to learn and make memories. Now, remember, she is a teacher. She is a special ed teacher. And here is the final quote. I don't want schools to become prisons or to become so locked down that you can't instruct, she told the Nevada Independent. You lose that collegiality and the fun that also should be contained within a school. And frankly, as you listen to some of the descriptions of what we want to do to quote-unquote harden our schools, what you feel like you are now describing are prisons. And it's interesting because I just went and visited the not-yet-opened women's prison in the state of New Hampshire. It's in Concord. And as I was thinking about all the things they needed to do to get into the building and the metal doors and the little buttons you needed to push and all this kind of stuff, and they're talking about that exact same behavior on schools. And I'm thinking, isn't it ironic? We are so quick to find the steel door, but we're not quick to find the textbook. We're so quick to find the bars on the windows, but we're not prepared to make sure that they have adequate teaching staff and enough materials, and teachers don't have to go out and buy, you know, extra paper and pencils for their schools. So I want to remind people, what is the purpose of education? All right? And this response to the mass shootings is not an educational response. It's a response that basically sort of aids and abets the NRA, but doesn't really address the problem. All right, everyone. We are going to now switch from guns, guns, guns to our first guest. And this is, I think, an important topic. It was at theconversation.com. And I framed it this way. Oh, Sinclair, what are you doing to my local news? And the title of the piece is, Why Are Sinclair's Scripted News Segments Such a Big Deal? Joining us right now from the University of Michigan and a fellow at the Peabody Media Center is Dr. Amanda, is it Lutz?
Yes, Lutz.
Lutz, great. And she's also the author of a very new, hot off the presses book that we actually love the title, We Now Disrupt This Broadcast, How Cable Transformed Television and the Internet Revolutionized It All. And it was just released by MIT Press in early 2018. So let's start first with this conversation about Sinclair News. And again, I'm going to be forthcoming here, Dr. Lutz, and that is that I get contacted by Sinclair because they have both a journalism section where it's print, and then they obviously have their news content. And I've been called probably a dozen times by some of the guys in Sinclair based out of D.C. to respond to a different number of issues. I'm a progressive, you know, talk show host, and I have a history of politics. And I remember saying to the reporter from Sinclair, if you ever screw me up, if you ever take me out of context, if I see this story is sort of slanted in such a way that you use my words against me, you will never call me again. And I will at least be honest, from the print perspective, they have been incredibly fair. But let's talk a little bit about who Sinclair is, what they've done, their ownership interest, and why this feels more insidious than anything we've seen in the past.
All right, that's a lot.
You got it, but you can start anywhere. Let's start first with Sinclair and their ownership.
Right. So I think one of the things that a lot of us have lost sight of over the years, let's say as many of American homes have either come to adopt cable or satellite, and at this point are now starting to drop those services. Now, if you can think back a couple decades ago, perhaps, you might remember that you could not receive your local stations, or perhaps you remember an era in which you could only receive local stations on cable. Now, all of this is a really important part of our regulatory history for television services in the United States. And those rules were designed and adopted and adapted over the years, and they were really designed to try to encourage localism, and that's really how our broadcast stations were designed. And so even though when you're sitting at home and you maybe turn on your television and you receive not only local broadcast stations, but cable channels that come from, you know, all over the country and are available all over the country, we've come to think of that as all just common television. But those are really two different entities that are regulated differently and historically, from a policy standpoint, have been understood differently.
So let me just mirror back. So what you're reminding us is that I lived in northern New Hampshire before I moved to Concord, and we only got one station, Channel 3 from Vermont. And that's because we had to use an antenna and, you know, those little rabbit ears to catch it. But that was free. We didn't have to pay for it. It was the local TV for Vermont. That was the only thing that we were actually within access to. But those kinds of stations, those local TV stations, were different from what we now see with CNN and MSNBC on cable. And therefore, because they were truly the public airwaves, they're definitely regulated differently.
Correct. And so here in Ann Arbor, where I probably could put up an antenna, but I haven't, I receive my channels by cable, I still receive 3-4 stations from Detroit, local broadcast stations, but they are on my cable package. But even though the technology that brings them into my home is cable, they are still understood as broadcast stations because that's how their signals do go out. That is their primary business. And so they have still those special rules that are for broadcast stations, not for cable channels.
And one of the things that you point out in your article, because this is a really good history lesson, is that we now have something called station groups. And that is not necessarily a new concept, but I think their ownership interest is growing. And Sinclair is now almost going to be the defining group within that station group concept.
Yes, Data Sinclair is already the largest ownership group. So again, that history, as broadcasting emerged, as television broadcasting emerged in the 50s in the United States, in many cases what happened was that local stations were developed by the same people who had owned the radio stations in different cities
exactly
and markets.
Right. That's exactly WBZ in Boston, radio, right? TV, absolutely right.
And often these were family businesses. Mm-hmm. They were based in communities. But what happened over the course of really the 70s and 80s is that instead of being locally owned family businesses, a process of consolidation occurred as companies recognized that there were economies of scale to be made by owning many stations instead of one or two, and that you could consolidate your operations and save money that way. And so often we again, because we're so familiar with networks, often the networks in our communities are not actually, those stations are not owned, they are affiliated. So let's say here in Detroit, it's WXYZ, it is the ABC affiliate. It is not owned by ABC.
Right.
It is a station that is owned by a different station group, and then it just affiliates with ABC in order to get its programming.
Mm-hmm.
And so what Sinclair is a company that owns many different television stations in many different cities. Many of those stations have different affiliations. So they have some ABC, some CBS, some NBC. And often, you know, you don't have any idea who owns the station in your local market.
Mm-hmm.
It may have changed ownership over the course of, you know, many years you might have lived in a community. So this is something that kind of operates sort of below the surface of most people's awareness.
So let's talk about what Sinclair is doing and has done, and it actually got caught doing because of, what was it, the Deadspin produced that video showing the chorus of local news anchors delivering the exact same scripted speech to viewers. By the way, that was just a brilliant catch. I mean, it was just, and it was the most powerful way of saying, what the hell is going on? Because you see the local anchors and you have a relationship with them. They deliver the news, the weather, traffic, closing of schools. You see them as kind of your man or woman that you've developed a sense of a relationship and trust with. And so when they start, you know, using these scripts, you didn't know it was scripted until Deadspin.
Right, right. Now, I think you're absolutely right in just how that this wasn't new, but this very powerful illustration of what is happening was released and shared widely over the Internet. So even though Sinclair and other station ownership groups own multiple stations, it has not been the practice to consolidate content. So that there is a local news director, as there's always been, and that news director decides what is the news in Detroit, what is the news in Concord, and decides how to cover it. Local reporters gather the stories, mm-hmm. and the actual content of newscasts has been locally created. What is different about Sinclair is that as a national entity, it is creating news packages or scripts, and not only just sort of making them available to stations if they needed to fill some time, but requiring the stations to incorporate them as part of their newscasts.
Well, what shocked me, because I have not heard this, Professor Lutz, come out of anyone, is that in your piece, let me just read this to you, and then I want you to explain to me why you're the first time I actually heard this. In fact, it's a practice that directly goes against U.S. broadcast policy, which asserts that local stations should serve their geographic communities and be allowed to refuse content offered by national networks. How the hell is Sinclair then, Dr. Lutz, getting around this broadcast policy with their must-run scripts and the requirement that they use these sort of completed news stories the way they have packaged them? I mean, this is the first time I even heard this, that it violates U.S. broadcast policy. So how come they're not being sued, and how are they getting away with it?
Well, I think what this really is a moment in which, like many other things that are going on in the news right now, it's an area where the regulation wasn't perceived as necessary. So the policy that exists, and the key word in what I wrote there is the word networks. So the policy that exists, it anticipated and was concerned about what happens when stations affiliate with networks, and that networks would force content on affiliates. But this isn't networks. This isn't NBC forcing the local
NBC
station.
It's ownership. Yes.
Right?
Yes.
So this was at the point that this kind of policy was last discussed, the ownership groups were not as significant, and obviously a practice like Sinclair's, which is relatively new, hadn't been proposed. Instead, the real emphasis and value had been on local broadcasting. And so this is an unanticipated practice.
So let me just say something. So I'm going to sort of play it out. So this hasn't been tested. So the question is, what's the difference between a network and a station group like this that owns 193 stations, where what they are forcing you to do is not geographically specific, sensitive to the geography? And if it was true for a network, how could it not be true for a mass owner? In a lot of ways, it's the same homogenization that people were concerned about with networks. Who cares whether you call it a network or you call it Sinclair? That same result and that same forcing of non-related or non-sensitive information is being enforced on stations, whether they want it or not, or whether it's relevant to their community.
Absolutely. And this is where, and I guess the policy action point here is the reminder that Sinclair does not own the public airwaves.
Yes.
Right? So this is, again, this very confusing thing, and we are now generations away from broadcast station licenses being sold by consecutive entities. But the airwaves themselves belong to the people. And the stations are what the FCC governs. It can't govern networks. It can't govern station groups. But it has the purview over the stations themselves. And the stations have to apply to the FCC for a license. And it has been the practice, since really the beginning of television, that those licenses are almost always renewed.
Right.
But the action point for communities that find their stations to be failing them at the local level is to write and to protest and to demand accountability at this moment of a station's license renewal.
So,
and basically illustrate that the stations aren't doing what they are meant to do.
Isn't there another opportunity here? Sinclair has a pending purchase of the Tribune's Media 42 stations. Couldn't this be an opportunity to actually finally get in and have the FCC define what is meant by, you know, the broadcast policy and the idea of the ability to refuse? Because what scares me is I'm watching local news. I'm not watching local news to be able to protest and whatever. If I'm a protester, I'm probably watching MSNBC or Fox, okay? Let's be honest here. So I'm watching my local content. I don't know that this is homogenized. I don't realize this. You know, I might be a little offended, but I'm not putting two and two together that I'm being force-fed this line that's coming out of some distant Sinclair operation and has nothing to do with my community. I might sense it, but I don't necessarily know. And that was, again, what Deadspin did, was show us that basically they were really working off some foreign script that has nothing related to my community. So I'm wondering if the Tribune purchase could be an opportunity for it actually to be spelled out.
I think it's an opportunity, and we probably wouldn't be paying attention perhaps in this way, but keep in mind that the Tribune purchase at most is 42 stations, and Sinclair already has, they believe it's 170 or so. So even if the Tribune purchase were blocked, you know, that's not going to change the existing problem. I mean, it is true that the FCC is actually going to have to change a rule to allow the Tribune merger to go through.
Well, then let's go on a roll. And why should it only apply to the acquisition of the 42 stations? If they're going to have to change a rule, then guess what? They can go back to the U.S. broadcast policy and change the rule and say that it doesn't just apply to networks, that it applies to station groups. I mean, if they're in the change mode, pick up your eraser and keep moving.
Have you been following our FCC?
I know. You're so cute. Because Susan Bruce is saying, yeah, I know. But I mean, but it's an opportunity to ask the question. It's an opportunity to put them on the hot seat again, not just about consolidation, but about the idea of has been exposed with Sinclair and the idea of this sort of local content. They may not move on it. They may not change the regulation. But shouldn't they be on the hot seat again, given the fact that they have an opportunity if they're in this regulatory change mode, that they could actually do this too?
Yes, you're absolutely right.
There are
multiple approaches that are warranted and needed at this moment.
So you're afraid. You're really worried about this. I'm really worried about this. I'm watching what's going on with Facebook. I'm watching what's going on with this. You know, I watched the election of 2016 where you saw, you know, $5 billion in free media that produced a Donald Trump. How do we start taking back the idea that these are public airwaves?
It's a very good point, and I think the other piece that I'd even layer in there at the local level in the states has to do with the loss of local newspapers.
Yeah.
And so, you know, to your earlier comment about, you know, you want to just sit back and watch your local anchors and not think about what's happening.
Yes.
But that local news is increasingly the primary way that Americans are getting any local information. And that's really concerning. And I think a reason to, you know, double down and revisit these policies in a world in which our media landscape has been forever changed by new media technologies that all derive their power and their value because of their scale. Not only are they national, they are international,
right.
And they become valuable because they can reach so many people. But part of that is that none of that has supported or encouraged much in the way of local content or local news and information development. And so I think part of the concern that American citizens should have is the difficulty increasingly of knowing about what is happening in your own community, because our for-profit media system, you know, has found that there is very little money to be made when you're only reaching an individual community.
So, Professor Lotz, if you had to look around the world, has anyone figured out how to ensure that local content exists, that it's supported? Is there a role model? I mean, I go to Finland whenever I want to think about good public schools, and, you know, that's where I go. Where do I look for a model that allows the support of local information, local reporting, and that kind of thing? I mean, I don't even know what to ask for.
Yeah, I think part of the problem is that we don't have a strong tradition of public media in the United States, mm-hmm. and a perception that it is it's right there with something like education, that is something that is we have to pay for because it's really good for us, and that only it's the only way that democracies can function. And I think there's a lot of attention right now on both the newspaper side and increasingly as local media entities recognize that they don't have to stay in their lane anymore. Radio entity can also publish news in print form online. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Audio providers can make video. Video providers can make podcasts.
Right.
Where I'm at in Michigan, because I'm not, Ann Arbor isn't in Detroit, we rarely get covered in terms of local news. We don't have a local newspaper anymore. Michigan radio has become really the key source here. So yeah. I think people who study localism are looking more and more to see what is working around the country. But I think the fact is that the economic, when you have media that is supported by advertising and commercials, the advantages of growing bigger are just too great. And that's really where all of the media organization's attention is. How can we scale it? How can we make it bigger? And part of doing that does not service local news production.
Thank you so much. Sobering conversation and a better understanding of why this is so offensive with Sinclair, and that the fact is they're able to sort of carve out this interesting exception because they weren't envisioned when they were writing those rules. They understood networks. They just didn't understand these station groups and nothing along the scale or size of a Sinclair. So big ain't necessarily better, I guess. Thank you again for joining us. I really appreciate it. Again, the title of the article, Why Are Sinclair Scripted News Segment Such a Big Deal? Amanda Lutz is a fellow at the Peabody Media Center and a professor of media studies at the University of Michigan. I hope you can join us again sometime.
Oh, it'd be my pleasure. Thanks so much.
All right, ciao. All right, everyone, a little labor history is next. This is The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and co-host Susan
I'm Rick
Bruce.
Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1937. That was the day the United States Supreme Court decided the case National Labor Relations Board versus Jones and Laughlin Steel Corporation. This case declared that the National Labor Relations Act of 1935 was indeed constitutional. Also known as the Wagner Act, it is a key statute that provides the legal basis for private sector workers to organize, collectively bargain, and to go on strike. Jones and Laughlin Steel, the fourth largest steel producer in the country at the time, had fired several workers trying to organize with the Steel Workers Organizing Committee in Aliquippa, Pennsylvania in 1935. The NLRB had originally ruled against the company and ordered the workers reinstated with full back pay. But J&L refused, arguing that the act was unconstitutional on the basis that the federal government did not have the right to regulate interstate commerce. In a 5-4 decision, the court ruled that labor management disputes did affect interstate commerce and thus were subject to federal regulations. Historian James Pope notes that the statute was upheld only after a massive wave of worker militancy, punctuated by the spectacular 6-week sit-down strike at General Motor Plants in Flint, Michigan, demonstrated what might have happened if the court decided the case differently. And in his book, The Last Great Strike, Little Steel, the CIO, and the Struggle for Labor Rights in New Deal America, legal scholar Ahmed White adds that the case was decided only after 2 years of legal uncertainty. Before Jones and Laughlin was decided, CIO unions were already negotiating and signing collective bargaining agreements. Ruling the Wagner Act constitutional has nonetheless benefited millions of workers for decades. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com, like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at laborhistoryin2.
The Pacifica Radio Archive celebrates Women's History Month.
I would like to begin this statement by informing the public that I wrote what I'm about to say. It's what I feel. I've never been forced to say anything on any tape. Nor have I been brainwashed, drugged, tortured, hypnotized, or in any way confused. As George Jackson wrote, it's me, the way I want it, the way I see it.
media magnate heiress Patty Hearst expressing her sober commitment to the revolutionary cause of the Symbionese Liberation Army in a communique presented to Pacifica Radio in 1974. Part of the Pacifica Radio Archives Preservation and Access Project, American Women Making History and Culture, 1963 to 1982. Funded in part by a grant from the National Historical Publications and Records Commission at the National Archives and Records Administration. For more information, visit us at PacificaRadioArchives.org. I'm Donna Walker. Thanks for keeping our women's history alive.
When the swamp gets drained in the broad daylight, watch the fire little vermin as he's slithering and squirming, trying to get out of sight. But when the tide goes out and it's all laid bare, they'll be slipping and sliding, trying to find a hole to hide, but there's no hole there. But when the first one squeals and the names get bad, they'll be rapping at each other as they scatter out the cover. When the swamp gets drained, there's no fat frog in its robes of black. He can ruin you and make you, but he's always on the take. You better throw him a snack. There's a two-faced snake in a high-priced suit. He's a most appealing creature till he turns around and beats you up a billion to boot. When the truth gets told,
ooh, when the swamp gets drained. Ooh, when the swamp. This must be the attitude with Arnie Arneson and co-host Susan Bruce. And Susan must have picked the music. When we think swamp, we think the Donald. Yes, well, who sings this song?
That is Will Gallison.
Yeah, who's Will Gallison?
I've never heard of him.
I never have, too. But when the swamp gets drained, it ain't happening yet. Anyway.
No, and ironically, he wrote this long before Donald Trump.
Well, you know.
I think he recorded this in 2011.
Huh. Little did he know, he'll become the theme song. All right, joining us as he does every Thursday, we make the schlep to Iowa State to join Stefan Schmidt, a.k.a. Dr. Politics, political science professor. And we've been talking to him for decades now, and he's been covering presidential politics and politics in America and around the world for decades as well. And I don't know about you, Stefan, but this last week has felt like 5 years. I can't keep up. I'm not sleeping at night. You know, this has really got to change. And maybe Paul Ryan leaving is going to be useful. Maybe that's going to actually happen. Maybe the Republican Party will implode and we can start from scratch. What do you think?
Well, the news this morning was fascinating because it's Republicans who are alarmed by Paul Ryan quitting. And they're saying, oh, this could be bad for the 2018 elections. Paul Ryan is a great fundraiser. He's raised, you know, millions of dollars for the party. Now they're going to have to pick a new Speaker of the House. The Tea Party is on one side of that. The establishment Republicans are on the other in terms of who actually ends up getting it and their names bouncing around. And so it's the kind of disruption that a political party doesn't really want at the kind of the beginning of the electoral season, because this is the beginning of the 2018 election. So yeah. It's that part, that whole thing is fascinating.
Well, you know, I wrote this. I wrote, this tweet sets the stage. And Ashley Parker actually tweeted this out before she knew about Paul Ryan. And she writes, White House in chaos mode. Oh, my God, Trump Tower is on fire. Oh, my God, they raided Michael Cohen's office. Oh, my God, we're going to bomb Syria. Whatever it is, there is. People respond to, there's no proactive strategic thinking. Now you add, oh, my God, Paul Ryan has left the stage. I mean, you just keep looking every single day. There is just one more story and one more story. And if they were in chaos before with this president, I can't even imagine in which direction his tweets are going to go.
Well, I read your tweet and I laughed when I saw it because it was right on the money. It's
absolutely
like, what are you going to say, oh my God, about? Because, you know, there are so many things just popping up all over the place. And frankly, I don't blame Ryan for saying, you know, geez, I've had it. It's a horrible, toxic environment. They've got a president that they can't do with and they can't do without. And, you know, the issues that I just gave a talk to a business group, and I have a slide that has all the things that need to be addressed and resolved. And it's daunting. It's incredible. You know, you still have the health care reform there.
Right.
You've got a budget deficit now that is
trillions.
Monumental without additional revenue. I mean, the spending part of it may be okay because they're spending on some things that are necessary. But if you also cut taxes at the same time, you know, you're not doing good because you're creating this massive burden. And Trump's, you know, whatever it is, I don't call it policy. It's just a kind of ping pong ball on Syria is incomprehensible. I mean, first he says we're going to pull out of Syria because, you know, that's not our war.
Yeah.
Then you have a gas attack. Then he says missiles are going to rain down on you. Then he says, well, maybe missiles are going to, but I don't know when they're going to, maybe they're not going to rain down on
you. I know.
And, you know, foreign leaders can't possibly plan anything around any of this stuff. And so it just harms the international environment. It makes the Republicans look, you know, terrible because they are the majority party and he is their president. And it's just really, it's anarchy.
Well, you know, it does feel like anarchy. And in a lot of ways, and I said this on our Friday show, we tape it in the morning, and I'm going to say it again,
yeah.
I tweeted it out, and that is that there was an article in the Atlantic Monthly, and the article in the Atlantic Monthly was written by, I believe, two Republicans who basically said, vote against any Republican. If you are going to save the GOP, you must vote every GOP person out. And the reason they said it is they were describing what is Trumpism. And they basically saw Trumpism as basically, you know, undermining the rule of law, not comprehending how we need to move forward as a democracy. And they said, now Trumpism has now captured the GOP. Therefore, in order to get back to the rule of law, you have to defeat the GOP to get back to what are the sort of original values and integrity of this country. I mean, it was an interesting, it was a syllogism. It was amazing. And yet, as you think about it, it really turns out that to a large extent, I mean, Paul Ryan, what I said this morning was that Paul Ryan, by deciding to leave the Speaker's office at this time, sends the worst message to anyone who wants to cut a check to a member of Congress. Why bother? Why bother?
Yeah.
You know, they're going to lose power. You're not going to have the Speaker's office. The Democrats are probably going to take control. So that drains. I mean, he may be a phenomenal fundraiser, but how does he fundraise tomorrow? I mean, let's go.
Well, that's right.
I mean, how do you go into a room and say, I'm bailing, so you should be cutting big checks? Really?
But Arnie, every time I mention to, I sent you something, I can't remember what it was now, where I answered some questions from, I think, the German news service or somebody. And they wanted to know, you know, yesterday, I mean, this is unbelievable. Yesterday I did a half-hour show with the most wonderful Romanian radio station. Yes, Romanian radio
station. They don't call me. Tell them to call me, too. I'm hurt.
One of my colleagues at Iowa State, who is originally Romanian, she said, this is the absolutely highest quality radio station in Europe, and it has millions of listeners, which I never heard of it. It's Romanian National Radio, and I think it's kind of like NPR in Romania.
Yep.
Well, you know, they wanted to know, do the Democrats have a chance of actually sweeping this and taking over at least the House, or maybe the Senate or not? And then I was hesitant because every time I say yes, you remind me that we have a lot of gerrymandering,
right,
which, no matter what the environment is, makes it that much harder for Democrats to win because their voter base has been chopped up into little slices in different districts.
Right.
And people don't understand this sometimes. Gerrymandering is you take the voters of your opponent and you chop them up so that they're not in one place, but instead they're spread around. Or you concentrate all of them in one single district, which means they may win that district, but they
nothing
don't
else.
Have voters left
they have no
in
influence.
The other district.
They have no influence.
And so this is a huge obstacle still for the Democrats. But gosh, you know, the Republican Party just seems so, I don't know, out of touch maybe. I saw the, you know, talk about the Facebook hearings, and I saw some Republicans just sucking up to Zuckerberg.
Oh, God, me
and
too.
Saying we don't need to have regulation and government regulations. You know, they never fix anything. These were Republican members of, I remember if it was the House or the Senate part, because Zuckerberg got basically, you know, hosed by both. And I'm thinking, you know, that doesn't even conform to what the media people in the social media world, the owners of these enterprises, including Elon Musk, and who has said very strongly there needs to be some regulation.
Right.
And the Republicans are saying, no, regulations never help anything.
Well, it was worse than that, because I felt like they treated, to some extent, they were actually asking Mark Zuckerberg whether he would support regulation over things like Facebook. Like is
right.
For him to say yes or no? When did he become the god? When do we need him to say
right.
yes or no? I mean, but that's exactly what we did with Goldman Sachs. Remember when the bankers came in and everybody was sort of, you know, asking them like in economic questions and investment questions, and they were flashing their POTUS cufflinks. You know, I mean, I am so offended at, even as they're trying to sort of say, we're going to crack down on this. Look at the violations. Look at the 89 million people that lost their access to privacy. And then at the same time, they're saying, excuse me, sir, would you support regulation? And I'm like, what kind of a question is that?
Well, that's right. He's the bad guy.
Yes.
It's like saying to someone who has committed a crime, you know, do you think we should incarcerate you?
Yeah, exactly.
You know, I mean,
and for how long? And for how long, really? And what, would you like an orange jumpsuit or stripes? You know, I mean,
that's
it's just, it kind of shocks
me. And you like chicken better than, you know, vegan or whatever. I don't know. It's just, it's nuts out there. And what I don't understand, I mean, probably the biggest story, though, with all this, you know, is the story of Donald Trump's attorney's office.
Yeah, his, Michael Cohen.
His
fixer.
His home.
Right.
And then the hotel getting raided by the FBI.
Yeah.
Very, I guess, very respectfully was the news.
Right.
That they came in and they had a warrant and it was legal. And, yes, they did have to actually break into the law firm.
Yeah.
Donald Trump was right. They broke into the law firm because they had to break the lock because there was nobody there to open it, because this was one of those dawn, you know,
early morning
before the sun comes up. And it's just like a terrible, you know, television series of, you know, crime series with the FBI breaking the lock and going in and then, you know, looking to see if they can find evidence for a whole bunch of different things. We don't know exactly what they were looking for.
Well, let me just say, but it's so brilliant what Mueller did, and that is by handing it off to New York and taking it out of the purview of Washington and his investigation, it creates a parallel track, but a track that the president can't touch. He can't fire them. He can't stop them. He can't stop the investigation. These people, I mean, this was so brilliant because, I mean, I think Mueller probably could have done it. He could have decided to investigate Cohen, but he decided, you know what, there was enough there that I have a legitimacy to hand it off to New York and say, you do it. And by doing it in a lot of ways, he ensured what he is doing.
That's absolutely
because
right.
It's like whack-a-mole.
And what, yes, it is. And
it's
the
whack-a-mole.
Thing is that he didn't need one more thing where the Republicans can say that it's a partisan persecution of Trump by Mueller, because, you know, he just basically said, here are some things that we need to look at and you guys do it. And it's fascinating because I don't know what the Access Hollywood, they're still looking for something having to do with President Trump's comments on that stupid bus on the Access Hollywood show about his, you know, groping women.
Well,
what
let
is
me,
it they're looking
well,
for?
Well, wait a minute.
Know?
So I have a CNN story that just came out. Here it is. National Enquirer paid to kill a Trump rumor. Now, I'm thinking, oh, God.
Oh, yeah, the doorman.
Listen to this. This is unbelievable, everyone. The publication gave $30,000. The National Enquirer gave $30,000 to a Trump building doorman to stay quiet over gossip regarding Donald Trump's sex life. All right. Now, I'm sure it wasn't gossip. He probably saw the women coming in, then the women going out, then the women coming in. So it's not just gossip. They were basically telling him, you're going to avert your eyes. You're not going to tell, you know, these are your lion eyes, sweetheart. And so Susan says to me, God, maybe we should have been doorman. I mean, think about it. I mean, we could use a cool $30,000. We haven't earned that in a year, you know? So it's so insidious because he has spent his entire life covering his tracks. His entire life, he's bought it off, he's contracted it off, he's sealed it off, who knows what he's done. And now he's in the biggest fishbowl he's ever been in, because while he may have turned the GOP into like this little, you know, mini trumpets, he hasn't turned the rest of the country, the media, or frankly the Democratic Party into that.
Well, that's right. And I can testify, having lived in New York in a building that had a doorman and an elevator guy when I was in graduate school, they know everything.
They do.
They know everything.
Oh, yeah.
Because they talk to everyone. They're friendly. They talk to everyone. They talk to other doormen who say, yeah, you know, I saw this person coming into our building with this beautiful woman who lives here. They know everything.
Well,
it's amazing.
No, let me just remind everyone. You're right, but Stefan, you know this and I know this because my aunt lived in a building with a doorman and my grandmother did. And the reason you hire doormen is that they are hired because they pay attention to detail. Let me repeat this.
Exactly.
Attention to detail. She went in with a backpack. She came out with a suitcase. She went in and her hair was neat and clean, and she came out and her hair was disheveled. I am just telling everyone, you hire them because they're supposed to notice. They're supposed to see change in behavior. They're frankly supposed to notice people that are coming. I mean, my aunt was totally robbed of art and jewelry and whatever, and what we found out later was the quote-unquote a doorman was in the bag. You know, that person was being bought off, so he wouldn't notice.
The National Enquirer had been paying for a doorman.
In Cannes, France, can you imagine? I mean, so I just want people to realize that it is not surprising, this story, and it actually sort of reflects what these people can find when they go into Michael Cohen's, you know, files, is that he probably paid off everyone because he wasn't acting as a lawyer. He was acting as a fixer.
As a pimp.
As a pimp. Well,
I mean, that's what somebody said.
That's
you
true.
Know. But the thing is, oh my
that's
God,
a pimp. I can't believe this.
Donald Trump has to be just. I mean, he's already, you know, got agita, and he's already, you know, his heart palpitations. But this has got to really be for him disturbing stuff, because he probably knows, you know, what Michael Cohen has and what probably was seized in terms of documents and so on.
Mm-hmm.
And they did it very carefully. You know, they had not only a search warrant, but they had people to verify that, you know, lawyer-client, you know,
privacy
wasn't being violated.
Right, right.
You know, and so, you know, gosh, you know, the media... And maybe part of the public, because I think the public is interested in scandal always, right?
Well, no,
I
mean, we like that. We have a purient interest.
Sure, and look at what happens when you go to a grocery store. Still, you don't see serious newspapers in the checkout line. It's still the National Enquirer, and there's still a space alien with three eyes, you know, who was seen somewhere down the street.
Huh.
And so the public does eat this stuff up.
Well, let me you're absolutely right.
There's got to be so much of it that's going to come
out. Well, let me just say something. I could talk to you ad nauseum about tariff policy. I could talk to you about NAFTA. I could talk to you about Syria. But I can talk. But as soon as I start mentioning that the reason why doormen exist is because of attention to detail, you watch everybody with the light bulb going, that's right. That's right. He knows everything. And that's the universality, sadly, of Donald Trump's bad behavior.
Is that popular culture, the kind of low end of popular culture.
Exactly right.
And,
well, sex sells.
And Donald Trump is so interesting because, you know, he is that. Most presidents are not. I mean, Bill Clinton was, to some extent, interesting that way. You know, because he had AstroTurf in the back of his El Camino pickup truck so he wouldn't skin his knees. And that was interesting at the time. And, you know, you can't beat a semen-stained dress, you know, which is in a museum now somewhere.
Right, right, right.
But this is equally interesting, and this is contemporary. Clinton is old.
Maybe more interesting.
But it's more interesting because he celebrated it.
Well,
because he made his reputation
so
on that.
So much more, I suspect.
Oh, well, I think he was a bad businessman.
Oh, well.
And it's his bad business that he had to really cover up for, than his sex.
Well, like I said earlier, he's Luca Brasi to Don Trumpione.
Yeah, Luca Brasi.
But that's so interesting, too, because Cohen is kind of like not just the pimp, but maybe more like the consigliere.
Yeah, that's what Susan was saying.
If you watch The Godfather right. or you know a little bit about the Cosa Nostra and so on, he's the fixer, the guy who knows everything, the lawyer, the one who basically stops things from happening that, you know, your employer and your boss, you know, just doesn't want. And so it's just fascinating.
So I want to talk about Mike Pompeo, because there's so much that we need to talk about with him. Speaking of Italians. So the former CIA director now is being tapped to be Secretary of State. And it turns out that we're finding out that he didn't disclose that he had businesses linked to a Chinese government-owned company when he was required to do that when he was being confirmed for CIA director by the Senate. Now, remember, this is the CIA director who fails to disclose his connections to a Chinese government-owned business. Got it. You know, if anybody should have gotten it, it would have been like the guy who's like, you know, going to be the head of the CIA. So now, you know, as he's failing upwards, and this time he's going from the, you know, the FBI or the CIA to Secretary of State, and now this has come out. What I think is interesting, though, Stefan, about the story is he's getting really grilled by members of the Senate. But what is more fascinating to me is that I think he's trying to cover his proverbial butt. So what I just heard this morning is that Mike Pompeo did something that Rex Tillerson did not. He reached out to all former Secretary of States, asking them for help to fill in all the hollowed out State Department. And in a funny kind of a way, I feel like that's almost a distraction. Look, I'm going to be a really okay Secretary of State. Ignore the fact that I forgot to tell you about that Chinese-owned business, because I'm reaching out to Hillary Clinton and Madeleine Albright and all these people because I realize that the State Department has a problem.
That is interesting. I mean, I think it is very interesting. But when you hire people and you don't vet them, or you deliberately don't want to know, then, you know, these surprise packages pop up, you know?
Yeah, well,
I mean, but the thing is, right now, I mean, the only ones who are going to really care about that are probably the Democrats, because the Republicans, you know, I think are okay with a lot of highly flawed members of the Trump administration, including heads of departments,
right,
you know, who are, you know, spending massive amounts of taxpayer money on things, turning on their sirens when they're going late to a French restaurant in Washington.
Oh, you must be talking about Pruitt.
It would have cost Democrats their jobs long ago, right?
Well, you know, I mean, I think they've decided that behavior has no value. That as long as they get the result, deregulation, as long as they get the result, how they got to that result, they're going to turn a blind eye. And that's problematic, because if they start turning a blind
eye,
and it's not, because you know what? In the end, the behavior becomes so insidious, it begins to impact the policies that they ultimately want, and not necessarily for the better.
You know, Pruitt cannot be really concentrating on his job of dismantling environmental rules when he's got essentially incoming missiles every day on the things that he's doing that are inappropriate, you know?
Exactly.
And it's the same thing with President Trump. You know, a couple of the people that I was giving this talk to said, how can he be concentrating on Syria and Russia and China and trade policy when his personal life is in massive turmoil and he probably doesn't sleep well at night thinking about that? How can he be concentrating?
Well,
and the answer is he doesn't concentrate anyway.
No, thank you. I was waiting for, if you were going to say it, I was going to say it. So people think that, I mean, but let's go to Pruitt, okay? Because I think Pruitt is a more appropriate one, because he also has incoming missiles, okay? And he technically has he's always been on an agenda. He hates the EPA that he's running. He's always wanted to deregulate, and he loves sleeping with oil, coal, and gas, okay? That's always been his agenda. And you saw it when he was AG out in Oklahoma, and you're seeing he brought that sort of ethic with him. Here is the problem for him, though. In a lot of ways, I'm kind of glad there are all these incoming missiles and all this distraction, because it's allowing whatever is left at the EPA to ignore him. That whatever is left at the EPA to actually do their job, because he is so distracted that he won't notice that they may be on occasion enforcing regulation, that they may be on occasion actually filing this report. And that, to me, is a good thing. I want Pruitt distracted, because when Pruitt's not distracted, he's doing huge environmental damage.
Well, you know, you have the most amazing ability to flip something upside down and have it make sense.
But it does.
Because that just made sense, you know? As long as you're too preoccupied with your, you know, your personal defense and outrage about, you know, well, I didn't know that these guys in my agency got these massive raises. The raises that those two employees there got were larger than most Americans' mean salary, annual salary.
Yeah, right,
and,
yeah.
you know, you can't imagine that the Democrats can't make hay out of it if they ever get their act together.
Well, but here's the problem. The problem is that what I perceive as corruption, they say as, wow, look at this opportunity. You know,
yeah,
I mean, how it's spun. It is actually spun that way.
Yeah.
You know, and that's where it becomes so unfortunate. So before I let you go, I there was one story that was making me sort of interested, and it was a story about the Pope. And I kind of like this Pope. And it was the headline was, pro-lifers dismiss Pope's declaration that protecting migrants is just as important as abortion. Oh my God. You would have think he had turned into the Antichrist, that they were saying what? Equally sacred? That the idea that His Holiness should suggest that the lives of the poor are also as important as the lives of the unborn. And they are furious.
That's really fascinating. And the thing is, there's nothing in any of the scriptures about helping the poor. So I don't know why they're so...
There is, in a
few places, actually.
Yep.
This is actually one strain of Christianity, is that you should take care of people who are, you know, who are basically out in the cold
and
need help.
Right, exactly. And it says, the Pope scolds Christians who dismiss social activism as superficial, worldly, secular, materialistic, communist, or populist, and who claim that the only thing that counts is one particular ethical issue. And what, of course, is that? And that, of course, is abortion. And you know what? That's the easiest one. You know that. So what I said is, you know why they like the whole idea of fighting abortions? Because the mother is responsible for everything. So while I have a baby in utero, I am feeding it, I am sheltering it, I am taking care of it, I am wholly responsible, and very little you can do is going to change that sense of responsibility. Once that child comes into the world and it breathes for the first time, then guess what? It needs to be fed not just by the mother. It needs to have a sense of security not just from the mother. It needs housing not just from the mother. That's when the heavy lift happens, and that's when they want to walk away.
Yeah, it's interesting. Well, the other thing, of course, is a lot of evangelicals and others are Protestants, and I think many of them are not really comfortable with a pope anyway. I mean, there has been this anti-Catholicism in this country, which is deeply rooted, and you can look that up. Don't use Google, because apparently Google is a bad thing, so use some other search engine.
All right. Well,
it's still there. Anti-Catholicism is still there, so it's easy to criticize the Pope.
And on that note, I need to say au revoir. Thank you so much for joining us. Stefan Schmidt is known as Dr. Politics. He teaches at Iowa State and joins us every Thursday at this time. Talk to you next week, Stefan. Ciao. Bye-bye.
Bye.
All right, we're going to end with this. Give me some truth. I'm sick and tired of hearing things.